From Michigan Public, this is Stateside. I'm April Baer. Today we're spending an hour with a dear friend and colleague, Don Gagne.
I want to tell people what I know and what I know to be true. I want to provide context, and then I want them to be able to come to whatever conclusion they feel is the best way to understand what's going on here.
As an NPR correspondent, Don covered politics, labor movements, and many Michigan people and places. He recently retired, leaving him more time to spend with us, talking about decades of stories.
It was not just a business story. This was just a very human story that was going to affect thousands of lives, the lives of those auto workers, certainly, but of their families, of their kids.
That conversation, plus your Michigan rock stories, today on Stateside. Welcome to Stateside. I'm April Baer. Good to have you with us today. Later this hour, a listener's story about falling in love and the rocks they met along the way.
She never threw any of them out, as far as I'm aware.
He'll pretend he's not mushy-gushy, but he can be really mushy-gushy.
That's coming up later, but first, Don Gagne filed the last in a long, memorable portfolio of stories for NPR this summer. A legend in public radio circles, over four decades, Don has covered global, national, and local events in ways that bridge the past and the present. A Michigander at heart, Don's reporting has always brought uniquely Michigan perspectives on politics, labor, and culture. He's taken listeners to battleground states, diners, barbershops, baseball fields, union halls, and other places. As he says goodbye to his day job at NPR today, he is also saying hello to a semi-retired life of Tigers games, summers on the lakes, Motown on the radio, and all the other wonderful things that Michigan has to offer. Don Gagne, welcome to Stateside.
It is so nice to be here. Thank you. And it's great to be in Ann Arbor and to be here in the studio with you.
You know, there was a rumor going around that one of the early filings that you did for NPR was the huge national story that broke out of Detroit when a violent attack was perpetrated on Olympic skater Nancy Kerrigan by associates of her fellow skater Tanya Harding. Is that true? That was one of your early clips?
Yeah. It was probably, you know, 7 or 8 years in. So I don't know if
okay.
It was, I guess, relatively speaking, that is early now.
Yeah.
But I was at Cobo Arena that day.
Uh-huh.
It was still Cobo Arena. And the U.S. figure skating championships, which in that year were the U.S. Olympic trials, were underway, and I was there on assignment for NPR, not because we knew all hell was going to break loose, as it did. I was there to interview the famed American ice skater Brian Boitano when the attack on Nancy Kerrigan happened.
Wait, did you see it?
No, I didn't see it. It happened like down a hallway near some of the practice rinks that we didn't have access to. But the commotion I heard, and I heard yelling, and I even heard screaming. We immediately knew there was a story going on that was not the story I was there to cover or practically anybody else. So.
There's this incredible archival tape of you filing, I think, from a payphone at Cobo Arena.
Yes. The first thing the doctor told us is that there is no fracture, but she was hit directly on the kneecap with this blunt object. Some have described it as a tire iron, others as a crowbar.
Wow,
Don.
Pre-cell phone. These days, so much of what we do happens over Zoom links or, you know, talking into the smartphone and uploading the file.
I had to find that cell phone in the bowels of Cobo Arena, and I
the payphone.
The payphone, and I had to make sure I was the one on the payphone when I needed it. So there were all of these different layers of getting your story on the air, and I also recall that day. It was so loud down there, and there was so much commotion going on. And the host, I believe it was Noah Adams, he started to ask me a question, and I realized I couldn't hear a thing he was saying. But I knew what time it was, and I knew how long we had.
Yeah.
So I just started telling the story off the top of my head and made sure I got out on time.
The skills you develop being in the field that no one else will ever quite understand.
And you're right on the edge of panic mode, but you don't ever go there because that would, of course, be the the end of it. You're just fueled by adrenaline and you're fueled by the need to give the show what it needs in that moment. So
the first time I ever met you was the presidential election of, I want to say, 92.
Okay.
And Bill Clinton was running. And I was growing up in Ohio, and I was working as a studio engineer at WOSU in Columbus. And I just remember that you showed up. So you had borrowed the studio to file for the network. I think Clinton had spoken, you know, to a student rally. And you came in wearing this seersucker suit. And I had met Scott Simon a couple months prior.
It might have been Poplin. I don't know if I had seersucker.
I don't know, man. I have a very vivid memory. Memory's tricky, but – and I just – Scott always looks really turned out too. And I just remember thinking these are who I want to be when I grow up.
No one has ever accused me of being dapper, I will tell you.
I don't know. We heard you cover a lot of campaigns.
Yes.
And of course, many other kinds of stories, less hopeful things like the automotive crisis happening during the Great Recession. As a Michigander, did you feel responsible for making people in other states understand what was going on with the industry here?
It absolutely was my job to not just report on the numbers. And the numbers were brutal, right? General Motors announcing, you know, a whole slew of plant closings in one day that was going to eliminate the jobs of a significant percentage of their hourly workforce, their UAW-represented workforce. So these were obviously monumental stories, but they were not just a business story. It was not just a business story. This was just a very human story that was going to affect thousands of lives, the lives of those auto workers, certainly, but of their families, of their kids, of the neighborhood, of the, you know, the grocery store where they shop, of the restaurant where they eat. And it ripples through the entire community. And I felt an obligation to try to get my head around that and try to explain the impact to NPR's listeners. And I will tell you, there were days where I thought that, boy, this is a really important story. I'm really glad I told it. And there were days when I could still feel like I wasn't getting my arms around the whole thing. It was such a time in this state, in that industry, and for the entire country. Clearly, it's a story that stays with me to this day.
Before we take a break, I want to play something that Don filed right before his retirement. One of the things I've always valued about his work, in addition to the quality and clarity of his writing, is Don's choice of sources. When you sit down to write a 3-minute radio feature, it can be a great shock to realize how little time you have to deliver a lot of information. And Don always maximizes that time by finding people who can express layered truths all at once. This is a story that aired on July 4th, looking at how Detroit reflects America.
I have spent the better part of my life in Detroit, where I am right now. And I started my career covering the auto industry and culture here. And on America's birthday, the intertwined history of these two threads here have a special resonance. In the 1920s, during the Great Migration, someone's mom or dad or grandparent came up north looking for a better life. And a good-paying job in the auto industry in Detroit was a much sought-after ticket to make dreams reality.
Because this is where my grandfather started his new life and his freedom.
That's Felicia Ford. She knows this Detroit story because it's her story, too.
My father and his uncles probably wouldn't have been born without being able to get a job, come to Detroit with the wage, build a family, have a house, and be prosperous.
Hundreds of thousands of Black Americans fleeing the Jim Crow South came to Detroit, arriving at the Michigan Central train station. A great many, like Felicia's grandfather, Roosevelt, were drawn by the promise Henry Ford made to pay workers in his car factories $5 a day.
He made his way to millwright, the skilled trades. Back then, they didn't have millwright school. You just brawn, you just had the toughness to do a millwright job.
Detroit's assembly lines gave the city its identity worldwide. And as manufacturing grew, so too did the region. Felicia Ford has followed in her grandfather's footsteps. She, too, works at Ford. She designs parts for electric vehicles.
A millwright would move and build machines that made the cars. I am designing the parts that would be in that factory.
So Roosevelt Ford's legacy continues to unfold. What about the cultural legacy of the auto industry from that era?
So we're in the grand foyer of the Detroit Institute of Arts. Right ahead of us are the Detroit industry frescoes depicting Detroit's automobile industry as painted by the great Diego Rivera, the great muralist.
Rivera painted these murals in 1932 and 33. Thanks to these massive frescoes, you too are inside that factory, feeling the noise, the heat, the rhythms, the dignity of the work, and the faces, so many faces, each one distinct.
They are each finely drawn, and he has created a multi-ethnic array of workers. That is Rivera's idealized view. You didn't have this kind of racial integration working side by side, almost hand in hand, like he shows them. What he does that I think is so great is that you can make out all of these individual faces. Each of these workers here, as represented by Rivera, would have a story to tell.
The frescoes tell a complex story, beautiful and maybe hopeful for those like me back here today, a story of the future and of struggle and of aspirations not yet fulfilled. In other words, an American story.
One of my very favorite places in the whole world.
We need to take a short break now. More with longtime NPR correspondent Don Gagne when we come back. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We're talking today with Detroiter Don Gagne. He reported for NPR for 40 years, covering labor and the economy, the White House, and American culture. Don retired this summer. These moments, you know, this inflection point in automotive, the Kerrigan and Harding story, these represent an era where it just feels like the things we were talking about were a bit more informed by a monoculture. Not to say that everyone's concerns and experiences were the same, but a more universal understanding of what's happening and cultural touch points. Do you miss feeling like those moments exist in the culture today?
Sometimes I do. I mean, mostly I just feel like I have to report on the world as it is, right? And not wish for it to be something else, at least not in my reporting and not on the air. But there was that time, not that long ago, it seems, that people weren't living in their own silos. They weren't choosing their news sources based on something that will reinforce what they think they already know or reinforce what they want to hear. And that happens, you know, all over the place in many different ways. And that does make our job harder because you have to try to, you know, figure out how your story can break through. And ultimately, the answer to that for me was always that I had to find the human element in that story. And I wanted people to know and feel that these are real people I'm talking to. and all across the political spectrum again. And I just wanted to know what they think and why they think what they think. You know, if I'm talking to voters, it's not my job to convince them that they're right or they're wrong. It's to find out what they think and why. And hopefully hearing that, hearing those voices in a very kind of, you know, sober and I hope thoughtful setting will help people make sense of their world.
When you started working for NPR, you had worked in Ann Arbor as part of the Michigan Public Radio Network for a while before you went to D.C. to take on the White House beat. And a lot of people may also remember you worked at WDET for a while. Mm-hmm. But you are a Spartan, sir.
I am.
What were the kind of stories that awakened you to what was possible for a life in journalism?
So it was very early on in my career that I started covering the UAW. And there would be issues at a local plant over some grievance or this or that. When I worked at WDET, I was doing morning drive. So I was up at like 4 in the morning and my air shift would end at 10. And then I'd basically have till noon or so to file stories for the afternoon crew, right? Except every day I ended up working till 4 or 5 or 6 p.m.
As one does.
And selling a lot of those stories as a freelancer to NPR. And that was how I built my early relationship with NPR. But I always found those stories from the union halls very interesting. And I grew up a working class kid in Monroe, Michigan, and I always felt comfortable in a union hall and talking to people on picket lines or whatever. And I just liked telling the stories of these workers. But in my first probably 6 months in public radio up in Flint, Michigan, they were having in the fall of, it would have been 1986, celebrations marking the 50th anniversary of the sit-down strikes.
Wow.
In Flint. The strikes actually started in December, I believe it was. But they're marking the 50th anniversary. And I should note as an aside, this fall will be the 90th anniversary of those strikes. But at the 50th anniversary, there were a lot of sit-down strike veterans still there. And, you know, the young ones were in their late 60s, early 70s. The older ones were in the 90s. But again, dozens and dozens and dozens of them showed up at an afternoon picnic at the Union Hall. And I showed up. I got sucked into these stories. And that foundational story of the United Auto Workers Union. And I can tell you that the conversations I had that day, the conversations I had in that place in Flint, informed my reporting on unions, be it unions in contract negotiations or unions and their involvement in the American political system, in endorsing candidates, and unions and the divisions that happen within unions when some of them decide they like Trump within one union, within one local, and some of them decide they like Kamala Harris or pick the election. And I would see those kind of divides start to form. All of that is endlessly fascinating to me. And my interest in it started in those early days going up to Flint, Michigan.
You mentioned the fact that you always felt comfortable in these spaces and talking to folks. What was life like growing up that gave you a taste for the storytelling and the sharing of stories in a wider way?
Yeah, I grew up in a household, 9 kids in my family.
Oh.
I'm the 6th of 9 kids, and you know, a big kind of classic Catholic family. All of my friends, except for a few of my neighbors, you know, went to the local Catholic schools and everything else. You know, my dad always had either a blue-collar job or at some point he got kicked up to like being a salesman, and then he got moved into the kind of white-collar office work kind of stuff at a company he worked for. It's just that Growing up there and growing up in that community, and there was a Ford factory down there, and there were, I knew kids whose parents were UAW. It was just something that I was always very comfortable with. Then when I was in college, going to school at Michigan State, you know, I had my summers off, and I landed a job working summers for the railroad. I worked for Penn Central.
Oh, my gosh.
And then Penn Central became Conrail. And my title those summers was track man. And I swung a hammer and changed rails and lugged railroad ties around and did all that kind of stuff for three summers in a row. That sure makes you comfortable walking into a union hall years later to go talk to workers, because I think they can sense that. I don't know if they can sense that you've done that kind of work, but they can sense if you know how to talk to them and know how to carry yourself in that place.
And understand what that kind of work means.
Yes, yeah. Yes. And what a day is like doing that kind of work.
If you're just joining us, my guest is veteran reporter Don Gagne, a Detroiter. Don, one of the things that has been great about NPR's system and the public radio system is hearing people bring their experiences to different beats. You know, I've always valued the fact that people, you know, get moved around to some extent and have the chance to specialize. I've always been so curious about what it was like for you coming up in those kinds of stories, in those kinds of spaces, to graduate to the White House beat. What do you remember about that transition?
I can tell you I never aspired to the White House beat. Many people do. That's like the golden beat that people want to have on their resume. And I was quite content being an NPR reporter in Michigan, kind of covering the broader Midwest and covering the issues that they gave me a lot of freedom to cover and to choose what my stories were. But when you're covering unions to the degree that I was, you start covering politics. You just do. In Michigan, of course, those union endorsements, and not just the endorsement, but the foot soldiers that unions provide in terms of canvassing and getting out the vote and informing their membership and holding candidate forums. All of those things are very important to the political process.
Inextricable.
In a place like this. So every election year, even though I would tell myself I was still on my labor beat, I was covering politics essentially full time. I mean, I remember going to one of the locals in Dearborn during Jesse Jackson's 1988 campaign and watching him speak to a packed house and just electrifying that union hall. Is that a union story or is that a political story or is that a civil rights story? It's all of the above. You can check all of those boxes. And those are the kind of stories that I felt it was really important to make it so our listener could feel like they were there with me.
The work of covering the federal government in D.C., especially the White House, though, I mean, the best reporters always have their sources outside of the briefing room. But in many ways, it's a highly reduced version of what we do because you're covering this day in, day out thing. And of course, you develop context. And of course, you develop information outside of what you're being fed. But what was challenging about that?
Going to one place most days to do my job.
Yeah.
And I would have a booth in the basement of the White House. It's NPR's radio booth. It's still there. And in a row with AP radio was next to me on one side. CBS radio was next to me on the other and so on. Voice of America. And there you were. So I found that very limiting, but what it did for me is it taught me how to work a closed environment, which an administration pretty much is, you know, how to develop sources within a place like that. But it also taught me, because when you're on the White House beat, you are pretty much the lead story on every show every day. So it taught me how to be a really fast writer, how to make sense of things fast, how to process things quickly, how to take what I had learned, and if it's too close to the start of the show, to just jump on the air live and do it and not get yourself in trouble with what you're saying. So it taught me a lot of skills. And the other thing when you're on the White House beat is where the president goes, you go.
Right.
Somewhat. I mean, you know, I wasn't on every single trip, but I was on nearly all of the overseas trips. You land in St. Petersburg, Russia, in Air Force One, and step off the plane. And these are all experiences. Just so few people get to experience that. And again, it's not for you. You're in the back of the plane. But to have that view of what it's like for a president to be greeted like that everywhere they go, all of that kind of helps with your understanding of that job, the presidency, and the trappings of that job. And you understand that stuff in ways that you don't when you're a news consumer or a reporter who's not on the beat, just because you're so close to it and you get to witness so many things.
There's so many things I'd love to ask you about covering the White House, but maybe just help me out with the timeline. You went to D.C. during Bill Clinton's presidency?
It was during the 2000 campaign that the editors on NPR's Washington desk started to think of me as somebody they might want to bring in to Washington to be part of the team covering the new administration.
Yeah. So you started in George W. Bush's first term. That was an incredibly catalytic time because of 9/11 and because of everything else that was going on domestically and abroad. Is there anything that you wish people better understood about that presidency?
You know, it kind of started in chaos. It started with the Florida recount.
Right. And this case of Bush versus Gore.
Yeah.
Which turned out to be pretty consequential in terms of election law.
And then it was, you know, 8 months in that 9/11 happened. And that turned everything upside down. And it changed the entire focus of the Bush administration. His focus was on tax cuts. He was also talking about things like immigration reform and, you know, education policy, things like that. It was a very domestic-oriented White House. From there, suddenly we've got the war in Afghanistan, the hunt for Osama bin Laden. We've got the war in Iraq that followed, which effectively was the undoing of the Bush presidency. I would look at Bush and realize that this is the person who was in the chair, in that job, when the planes flew into the World Trade Center. And that informed everything he did after that. And it's one thing for it to shock all of us and to change all of our lives, as it did. He was the one who had to do things about it. He obviously left office with his approval ratings just, you know, in the basement. To this day is a very controversial and polarizing figure as president.
Well, would it be safe to say that it was a unique experience even among American presidencies?
Certainly that. Now, every presidency is kind of unique in and of itself, but the events that played out that happened were things that we are all living with today still. And some of the decisions that he made, we are still living with today. You can hear me struggling with how to characterize it.
As one thing, yeah.
As one thing. And there were so many areas where the response that he may have thought was going to be just the thing to respond to this appropriately led us down the wrong path as a country. And those things have begat other things, which have begat other things. Do we draw a direct line between the decisions he made and the election of Obama? We absolutely do. But do we also draw lines between that and the election of Trump? Yes. So it's very hard to give a simple answer or even kind of a direct answer to a question like that.
We're going to take a break and then continue talking with longtime NPR reporter Don Gagne. Before we do, let's listen to some of what Don shared from his White House assignment on September 13th, 2001.
I think about the families, the children. I'm a loving guy, and I'm also someone, however, who's got a job to do, and I intend to do it.
The president was very visible on this day, but one of the questions he was asked dealt with his lack of visibility on Tuesday, the day of the attacks. There was some criticism, even from some in his own party, about his absence from Washington until Tuesday evening. His aides, seemingly sensitive to the portrayal of the president on the day of the disaster, offered an explanation yesterday. They said there had been credible threats against the White House and Air Force One that day. Today, the president himself responded.
I know I took the appropriate actions as the commander in chief to be in a position to be able to make the decisions necessary for our government to handle the crisis.
We'll be right back. You're with Stateside. This is Stateside. I'm April Baer. We're talking this hour with Detroiter Don Gagne, former White House correspondent for NPR, who also provided extensive coverage over the years of labor and American culture through four decades. Politics coverage is not easy. It never has been. May I just ask about your approach to covering partisan issues in a way that you felt was true to the experience of the people you were talking to, as well as for listeners who had their own experiences that told them different things?
I think the way I would put it is I want to tell people what I know and what I know to be true. I want to provide context, the best context that I can, and then I want them to be able to come to whatever conclusion they feel is the best way to understand what's going on here. And if I tell you something on the radio and in my reporting, you should know that this is what I have been able to learn based on the facts. Again, I'm not a commentator. What I say on the radio is what I know to be certain, and then people will make their judgments.
You returned to Michigan many times over the years while you were based in D.C. When you lived in Washington, did you always know you'd return one day?
I always assumed we would come home to Detroit or to Michigan. We were in Washington 24 years, so that might have been a little longer than we'd anticipated when we left. But even when we lived in Washington, vacations were always back home in Michigan, and more often than not to Southeast Michigan, because that's where family was. And we would come here more to see family than we did to go up north or whatever. It's always been a place that has not only been a draw personally, but for me, it's also always been a great place from which to frame the story of the country that I was trying to tell.
Can I just ask you about this moment in our industry? NPR and all local stations are facing some different times. NPR was asking for people to step up and take buyouts, and funding models are changing. How are you feeling about things right now?
I feel like this system will survive. I feel like listeners will support us. The challenge, of course, is adapting to the new ways that people consume news. So we're still on the radio. We're obviously reaching the largest chunk of our audience via the radio wave still, and millions of people around the country interact with NPR in that way. But we have to be on all the other platforms, and that's always a challenge.
I just have to say it was a joy in the months and weeks leading up to your exit hearing you file a whole bunch of stories that I – the like of which I had not as often heard from you about fun and interesting Detroit things. Before we go, I want to play part of one of the stories Don filed about Motown, which first broadcast this summer.
We had the 45 of Jackson 5, I Want You Back, and then on the other 45 was Rockin' Robin.
That's Jamon Jordan, the official historian for the city of Detroit. He says Motown created a sense of pride and an identity so ingrained into the fabric of the city that you can't untangle the two.
Motown has become for Detroit what whole industries have become for other cities. Like when we think of Milwaukee, of course, we think of beer, Pittsburgh and steel, or Houston and oil, you know. But Detroit, it's not just Detroit and music. It's Detroit and Motown. I need love.
Motown Records, founded in 1959 in a modest house on West Grand Boulevard by a 29-year-old Barry Gordy. The label quickly became so big that it gave the city itself a new nickname. The Motor City was now Motown. Barry Gordy had actually worked on a Ford assembly line. He would write songs in his head to break up the monotony of a shift with the machinery of the plant, keeping time. And he brought some of that mindset into his recording studio. Songwriters had one job, engineers another, and so on. Suzanne Smith is the author of the book Dancing in the Street, Motown and the Cultural Politics of Detroit.
The Funk Brothers, the Motown studio band, I mean, they literally would play different, you know, licks or, you know, certain bars of music, and they would break them down, and there would be certain pieces of songs that they would just insert in different records. The way in which you'd put a bolt on an axle of a car, you know, in a couple of the songs, they would shake car chains in the studio to create a percussion sound.
There were also historical factors that helped make Motown possible. In the early 20th century, Detroit saw tremendous migration of African Americans from the South. That led to growing neighborhoods like Black Bottom and vibrant entertainment districts like Paradise Valley. Local clubs like the Flame Show Bar showcased talented jazz and swing musicians. Jordan says all that paved the way for Motown's success, even as those neighborhoods would later be lost to federal urban renewal projects.
I can't take you to Paradise Valley because it was destroyed when they built the I-375 and I-75 freeway. I can't take you to the Flame Show Bar. It was destroyed when they expanded the Detroit Medical Center. I can't take you to Black Bottom. It was destroyed through urban renewal. I can't take you to those places, but I can take you to Motown. I can take you to the Motown Museum, where I could play some Motown records for you.
Marion Hayden is a renowned jazz musician who is from Detroit and still lives here. She got to know some of Motown's early session musicians and says you can hear the jazz roots in classic Motown recordings.
Now, these musicians have that special thing that jazz musicians do, which is to be able to improvise and provide something that is perfect for the moment. And that's what Motown captured.
One example? Motown musicians took a riff from a jazz standard called Canadian Sunset and turned it into the introductory bass line of Mary Wells' My Guy. Hayden demonstrates for us on her bass in her living room.
So then you get...
And if you're a working musician in Detroit today at any level, Hayden says you better know your Motown catalog.
If you're at a party and someone says play Dancing in the Street, they don't expect you to go look in your folder and find a piece of music.
Everybody knows it.
You should know that.
That universality is emblematic of what Barry Gordy wanted, songs that would appeal to a broad audience, black and white Americans alike. But let me tell you what else was going on in Detroit back then. Racial tensions boiled over in the summer of 1967. 5 days of unrest left more than 40 people dead, mostly at the hands of law enforcement. In other parts of the country, Motown artists were still playing segregated venues. It was a stark reminder that there were limits to music's power to unify. Author Suzanne Smith.
White people liked listening to this music. They liked that it made them feel good, but they sure as heck didn't want to, like, have black people move next door.
Berry Gordy himself was involved in the civil rights movement, releasing recordings of Martin Luther King's I Have a Dream speech. But worried about alienating white listeners, he pressed his artists to avoid politics and social issues in their music. That didn't last. That anti-Vietnam War anthem by Edwin Starr topped the charts. By the early 70s, other Motown acts like Stevie Wonder and The Temptations were weighing in on the events of the era. Segregation, determination, demonstration, integration, activation, humiliation. Despite Gordy's initial misgivings, such songs expanded Motown's impact far beyond that Detroit house where it all got started. In fact, Motown's reach was on full display in 1990 when Nelson Mandela visited Detroit. It was just months after his release from prison in South Africa. He'd been held for 27 years for challenging the country's apartheid regime.
When we were in prison, we appreciated and avidly listened to the sound of Detroit, Motown.
He spoke from center field at a packed Tiger Stadium, quoting Marvin Gaye.
Brother, brother, there's far too many of you dying.
I was there that night. The energy in that stadium as Mandela spoke those lyrics defies description. That moment captured everything that Motown is, a hometown institution and a global powerhouse, an apolitical music label that fostered political rallying cries. Today, it is still the soundtrack of the city in clubs, at family reunions, in local parks, echoing between innings at a Tigers game, and of course, blasting from car windows in the summertime. Don Gagne, NPR News, in Motown.
Don Gagne, it is such a pleasure to get to talk to you and to have you back in Michigan. Thank you so very much.
It's really a pleasure. You guys do amazing work here, and I'm so glad you guys are here and going strong, and I'll come back anytime.
Let's close out the show today with a love story. Here's On Hand producer April Van Buren.
In the most recent On Hand, we answered a listener question about Petoskey stones, and we heard from a few people who really love collecting rocks.
There's been days that the next day you definitely know that you were rock hunting the day before. hours.
You feel it in your back?
You feel everywhere.
And today, we're going to hear from a couple who have been collecting rocks as an expression of their love.
My name is Maggie Reinhart.
Yeah, I'm Benjamin Reinhart.
Maggie and Ben are now married and live in Muskegon with their two young daughters. But back in May of 2020, they were looking for love in the same place a lot of us do, a dating app.
We always made the joke when we first started dating that we should come up with some really cool story of how we met, of like skydiving or something extreme.
When they met, both Maggie and Ben had recently gone through breakups with long-term partners. And despite the chaos and confusion of the pandemic, Their new love blossomed.
I don't know that there's a day that we haven't talked since May of 2020.
One day, while they were getting to know each other, Ben spotted an interesting-looking rock.
I don't know if it was just a whim or if it was heard a story or saw a video. I don't know what it was, but I picked up the first rock. I'm assuming it was probably pretty close to the start when we were actually able to go outdoors and do things. And I found a heart-shaped rock and I gave it to her, and she ended up keeping it in her car, and it just kind of, like, her car became the collect-all.
Ben says he can't remember exactly where he picked up that first rock.
I think it was, do you remember that dinner we did with your dad and Noel at Texas Roadhouse?
Oh, you think it was Texas Roadhouse parking lot?
I do.
How romantic.
I know. I honestly thought it was a little cheesy, but I thought it was really cute.
After several times of me cleaning out her car, the rocks then made it into the house at that point. And I ended up getting like cigar boxes, and just they were then overfilling where you couldn't even close the lids anymore. And so she never threw any of them out as far as I'm aware.
He'll pretend he's not mushy-gushy, but he can be really mushy-gushy, which I think is adorable because I only get to see that part of him.
Maggie has held on to that first heart rock and all the other ones since.
I told him that we're kind of like penguins. So when he brings me a rock, it just makes me think that he's thinking about me. And that's why he gets it. So normal people get a text message saying, hey, I love you. And I get a rock. And not the diamond kind. The one that you find at a playground or something like that, or in gravel.
Whether he's traveling for work or for his hobby of Civil War reenactments, Ben has trained his eyes to quickly spot the perfect rock.
Yeah, I think it's just a habit now of just looking down at the ground and looking for one real quick. And I only spend like 30 seconds or so trying to find one. And if I find one, it goes in my pocket until I see her. And there's been plenty of times that I go, oh, crap, hey, I have some for you. And then in my car, I take them out of my cup holder or something.
I spent a lot of time alone as a kid. And so it was one of those things of like having that reminder of like, even though I might have been in a different space than he was, or if we're in the same spot, but he picks up a stone, even if we don't like remember that that stone is exactly from there, it's still like I'm still on his mind, even if I'm right next to him or if he's states away. And that reminder that he's still going to be there no matter what.
Thank you so much to Maggie and Ben for sharing a bit of your love story with us. And thanks to our listener, Tim, who also called in with his own rock collecting adventure. It started when Tim was 17 and hiking across the state of Michigan one summer. He set out from Sleeping Bear Dunes and ended the trip in Tawas on Lake Huron.
I weighed my backpack shortly before I left on the hike, and I waited again at the very end near the district ranger station, and the weight was approximately the same, which was a little surprising because as I was hiking along, I decided I didn't need this item, didn't need that item, and I was, you know, disposing of things as I went along, down to the point where I had one change of clothes and one cooking pot and one fork, one spoon. Pretty basic. And the reason the weight was the same is because as I was walking along on the trail, keeping my eyes open, came across a rock that I thought was pretty cool. And I would pick up the rock, and eventually it made its way into my backpack. Still have them to this day. It started another lifelong habit of mine, and that was wherever I went, I would pick up a rock, at least one, from where I was at and add it to my collection. I have a pail of rocks sitting at my front entry. And it's been there to this day, and I've kept all of those rocks.
That's Stateside for today. I'm April Baer. Thank you so much for listening. We'll see you tomorrow.